This is Developer's Journey. My name is Tim Bourguignon. Thanks for joining. And we're live. I have with me tonight, yes, because it's night, Jens Schauder. Hi, Jens.
Hi, Tim.
Nice to have you finally on the line. It's been a heck of a quest to get you on there. Google Hangouts didn't want to play with us. We're finally back on Skype, and so far so good. It's working.
Yeah, finally.
Finally. You're a very special guest because you were on the program already once, but nobody beside me and a few other people got to hear you. I recorded a very long and very interesting interview with you and one of your mentees, Thomas. It was all in German, and since I decided to post the podcast on in English, this will not end up on air. But it was a very interesting discussion about mentoring. At one point, we'll have to get this back somewhere or another. But tonight, I wanted to speak to you about something else. Last time we saw each other was at the Frühjahrscampus, the conference my company is organizing every year. And you held a talk about JUnit 5, isn't it?
Correct.
Yeah, it was called JUnit Lambdas or something like this.
The original title was JUnit Lambda, the next generation. And but when I actually did the talk, I changed the title to JUnit 5 because that's what the project did. They started out with the name JUnit Lambda, and but for some time now, it's named JUnit 5. So it's the next version of JUnit, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I went there. Not just because you were presenting, but also because I was interested in the topic. I said, well, okay, so Jens is going to show us how JUnit is working. And there I learned something very interesting, besides lambdas in Java, which are coming quite late in comparison to C#.
Yeah.
That's the mandatory bashing. So I learned that you're actually kind of participating in the project. Which was an interesting cliffhanger for me. So you're doing open source. You're doing not just open source on your project, but a project from somebody else.
Yes, but only very, very little. I mean, okay. I basically do no coding at all in JUnit 5, with a single exception of one pull request that we might talk about later when we talk about dgraph. But I try to help JUnit 5 because for me, JUnit is, I think not just for me, JUnit is the possibly most important Java library that exists. Basically, everybody is using it. And if you're not using it as a Java developer directly, you are at least using some library which was inspired by JUnit. And, yeah, and I think JUnit needed a next version. JUnit 4 was already quite old, and as you realize, Java has lambdas now, so there are some cool things you can do with lambdas, and which are really, really nice for a test framework.
Mm-hmm.
So how I participate in JUnit 5 is really mainly by doing this talk on various occasions and doing marketing for JUnit as I do right now again. So this is actually working on an open source project if you want.
Yes, it is. And that is really cool. That's exactly the kind of things I want to put out there is whatever you're doing when you're speaking about it and promoting it and bringing the attention from other people on it. It's already doing open source and that's really great. You said you had one pull request accepted?
Exactly.
Question mark?
Exactly. The point where I really participate or actively do the coding in an open source project is my own open source project, dgraph. Mm-hmm. And it's a library to check for cyclic dependencies between packages, something that I consider really important not to have, the cyclic dependencies. And
I was about to ask.
As I do a lot of talks, I obviously talk about dgraph, and actually JUnit 4 was always an example for me in my dgraph talks to show how it looks like when a library or a project has cyclic dependencies. And so when they started work with JUnit 5, which is basically a complete rewrite from scratch, they approached me and asked if I don't want to provide a test based on dgraph to ensure that JUnit 5 stays without cycles. And of course I did that. I mean, that's kind of the coolest thing that can happen to a little irrelevant open source library like dgraph. So I did a pull request, and by this I have a single commit that I added to JUnit 5. I don't know.
You were in there.
Maybe they will get another one there for, like, I don't know, comments or fixing typos or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. But that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
So some of your code will be nurturing future generation of coders on JUnit 5. That's great.
Exactly.
Yeah. And this is one of the special features of dgraph, right? That you can write tests that check your cyclic dependencies.
Exactly.
Not just on IL, but yeah.
There are basically two ways or two things that dgraph can do for you. It can check for cyclic dependencies and actually for other dependencies that you don't want to have in your code as well. And the problem with this is there are many libraries that can do that for you. But once you found that you have a cyclic dependency, it can be really difficult to get rid of it. Or a similar situation, which was actually the situation which triggered the original development of dgraph, is if you have a huge package and you want to split it apart, from just looking at the source code, it can be really difficult to see, like, what parts of this package make sense to move out of that package together in a new package. Mm-hmm. And so what dgraph does as well is giving you a graphical representation of your dependencies. So you have the classes with arrows between them for dependencies, and these classes are in boxes, which represent the packages. And packages, again, can themselves be inside boxes, which are things that I call slices, because I didn't find a better name. a slice can be something like a technical layer, like everybody does, UI, domain logic, persistence, something like that. Or, which I think is way more important, something like business module. So the not very inspiring example is you have customers and you have orders and you want to have them in separate modules. And if you structure your code at least somewhat reasonable, these module names appear in your package name, and with dgraph you can use that package name to basically identify pieces that go in one module, and then dgraph checks that also on this module or slice level, the dependencies are cycle-free.
And you can kind of create violation rules, right? Or something like,
exactly.
Like this?
Exactly. You basically write a test, a JUnit test, or whatever framework you want to use. It doesn't depend in any way on any test framework. You have a real simple test, which basically say, well, this is the code I want to analyze, which is basically, in most cases, the current class path. You can define how your slices are defined, which is like with the ant-like syntax, where you have like stars or double stars for matching parts of a package name. And then you basically can say, well, these are the dependencies I want to allow, and I want all these rules to hold, and I want to have it cycle-free.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sounds great. And you said this came out of a project you were doing. You had a big project already running, and you needed this, so that's how you kicked it up?
Yeah, that's basically, I remember way, way back when the first project where I was basically assigned the architect. I remember very well grabbing all kinds of magazines and books and like, what is an architect supposed to do? And I learned a really lot. And one thing I remember very well was this idea that packages should be cycle free, and that you have technical layers and you have modules and this kind of stuff. And already back in that project, I decided, well, let's try that. Let's keep our packages cycle-free. And it worked really well, especially since that project back then grew a lot. So we started with a single Maven module, and at the end of the project, I think we had about 50. We really appreciated that we did not create cycles, because we could just we basically had the borders of the later Maven modules inside our code already from the beginning. So that was really nice. And back then I wrote the test with JDepend, which is another library which does dependency analysis and is one of the libraries that you can use to prevent cycles. But then in another project, I basically did the same thing. But what happened there was at some time I looked in the code and I realized that the other developers in the team found a package structure which is guaranteed to be cycle-free, which is a package structure consisting only of a single package. So it wasn't literally all classes in a single package, but there was one package that was really, really big, with like, I don't know, 200 classes or something.
That started to become big, yeah.
So I decided I want to split up that package without creating new cycles, obviously. And then I needed a tool, and I wrote a little tool back then, which depended in a lot of ways on that current project, but which already basically did what dgref does now. It analyzes the dependencies, writes that information out as GraphML, which is an XML format for graphs. And I used YEdit, which is a free graph editor, to visualize that. And when I was done with that and left that project behind, I decided that I want this tool, and I want it independent of any project, so I rewrote it, and that was the birth of dgref.
Okay, that would have been my next question, is how did you get the license rights after writing this for your day work? But you said it, you rewrote it from scratch.
Yeah, I rewrote it from scratch. I actually used a different programming language. It's written in Scala, basically just because I wanted to learn more Scala back then.
Okay.
And and also the original version, which gave me the idea, had dependencies on the project itself. There were some design decisions that were okay for that project, but not okay for a library.
Yeah, so it's the experience architect now.
Exactly.
And why did you decide to put it on GitHub and make it open source?
Well, the question is really, why not? I wrote this tool basically for myself, but of course it is really cool if you create something and somebody else is using that, and especially if they then come back and say like, hey, this is cool, that helped. And there's really not much I was to lose. The only reason not to do that would have been if I would try to sell dgraph in some way. But there's no way I can put as much time in it that it would be worth selling. So if you look at dgraph and look at what it's doing and sit down for, I don't know, depending on your speed, a couple of days or maybe a couple of weeks, you probably can recreate it. And there are already commercial tools that do stuff like this. So there was really not a reason not to do that. So all I had to do was do it through this awful process of deciding for a license. And then put it on GitHub. I mean, I want to have some place to store the source code anyway. And I don't know if at that time even things like Bitbucket existed where you could have private repositories. But there really wasn't a point to make it private.
Okay. And you probably have countless repos now.
Yeah, I don't know how many. Maybe a dozen or two.
Yeah. And the same on Bitbucket.
Actually, no. On Bitbucket, I have exactly two. There's one. They are private repositories. I go for Bitbucket if I want to have a private repository. So there's one thing I'm working on, which is a little game, which is supposed to be a game for developers. So whoever will play this game will have to write code and play against other players against the server. And if one of the players would know how the server works exactly beforehand, he would get an advantage. So I don't want that, so that's why that is in a private repository. And the other repository is a workshop I'm preparing, which is actually more an thing for my employer. So it should really be in a repository of two systems, but big companies getting a repository there that I can access from everywhere. And it's
I understand.
There are faster ways
to do
that.
You know this is gonna be public, right?
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah. So you said you got a few comments from people using it. Did you get pull requests? Did you get design questions? Did you get some feature requests?
I've got feature requests. Yeah, that's the great ones. Although that's also the stuff that creates a lot of work that I don't get done currently. and feedback. It's really, there's a huge range. I mean, GitHub has this little thing where you can star libraries, basically liking them. That's an awesome little piece of feedback. I always kind of get only a little, but I get a little excited when I see like, oh, there's another one. I'm starring my library. It is kind of ridiculous, but well, that's how humans work, or at least I work, and I guess many other people work similar. There are often questions how to get it working. I guess usability is not the absolute strength of dgraph. There are things that you can do wrong, and probably dgraph doesn't really give you that much help. So there's, in many cases, I look at these things and can very directly tell people, what went wrong. So, but it's I can understand it's hard if you're not familiar with how dgraph works. This is one thing I get quite some kind of feedback for. And then, yes, feature requests. There's one big thing I really want to do, just I don't find the time for it. Dgraph currently can't ignore dependencies. So okay. Dgraph is, I think it's pretty great for new projects. But if you have an existing project, and if I do talks about dgraph, sometimes people tell me, like, yeah, I have to give that a try, and I want to see if I have cycles in my project. And I basically tell them all the time, well, for that, you don't need dgraph. You have cycles in your project. If you have a non-trivial project and you never checked for dependency cycles, you will have some. It's basically a given. But if you have a large project, you will have a lot of cycles, and it won't be easy to get rid of them. And it's actually debatable if it makes sense to get rid of all the cycles in an existing project. I think it's worth the extra effort to avoid them, but getting rid of them, if there are many, I'm actually not that sure. But then if you want still want to use dgraph to write tests, you need a way to basically say, okay, I know I have a dependency from here to there, and that is really stupid, but just ignore it for the analysis. Yeah, there are some other changes I want to do in the little DSL that you use for writing tests, and it just takes forever because I can't find the time to work on it for more like half an hour in one go.
I can relate to that. I can relate to that. If you were to summarize what you got out of it, what putting or writing dgraph and putting in open source and participating in open source, what have you gotten out of it?
Even from a tiny library like dgraph, I learned a lot. Like how hard it is to keep a library compatible with its previous versions. That's something the official version of dgraph is currently, I think, 0.13, or is it 0.1.3? I don't even know the number. The important part is it's a zero version. So, I'm basically telling everybody, if I think I messed something up in the API, I will break it without any warning, which shouldn't be a problem for anybody, because normally you write one single test per project with this library, and if you have to rewrite that, that shouldn't take you longer than 15 minutes. But if you just start imagining what kind of work it is to keep a bigger library, something like even JUnit, which isn't that big as well, compatible between the versions. That's a lot of work, and you have to put a lot of thought in your API, like what do you put in there, what do you leave out. That's a lot of thought that you are not used to when you work in normal projects, where you have all your code and all the code that uses your code under your control. So that's a big difference. I've seen a lot of code, a lot of projects that I analyze with dgraph. Actually, I found some kind of anti-patterns, that stuff that people tend to do with packages, which at least I consider a really stupid idea. and sometimes just mistakes that happen even if you try to do it properly. One example would be that there are two kinds of code that tends to end up in packages like common, and one code is code that really depends on nothing in your project. The stuff like string util and this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But then there's also stuff that basically depends on all of your project, which is basically something like your main method or something like your Spring configuration classes, if you use the class configuration. And this kind of stuff basically depends on almost everything in your project. But both of these kinds of things have one thing in common. It's hard to find a proper name for them because they aren't part of some kind of business module. So I see it in many cases that I've done so myself that people put these two things in the same package.
Mm-hmm.
And which obviously immediately creates dependency cycles. So you see them with dgraph, and then you look at them, and with a little thought, you actually realize what's going on, and then split them apart.
Mm-hmm. Or you need three packages, so commons, misc, and maybe the German sonstiges.
Yeah, exactly. Preferable with a umlaut.
Yeah, exactly. Just to be sure. Did you write a talk about this? That would be a great talk. So
about what I learned when...
Yes.
No, I didn't.
So kind of forensics after so many projects you opened up.
I wrote a talk about these anti-patterns, yeah. I have a talk. I think I did that at HAPS Campus at least once. Yeah, I think so.
Could be. I was not much into Java a few years ago, so I'll link it to the show notes if you send me the links. If you have the version somewhere, do you have it online somewhere?
I don't know. I have to look. Maybe possible.
Let me know. I have one more question. You gave a funny definition of the architect, or what the architect was for you when you started this job. So the guy that is looking after dependencies, after order, technical layers, modules, etc. What would be your definition now?
Oh, well, that wasn't intended as a definition. It was just one task or one aspect of architecture. And structuring the code or making sure that code is structured in a useful way. I still consider that one part of architecture. Architecture for me is, I don't know from whom I stole that definition. Stefan Zörner uses it a lot in his talks. For me, architecture is the collection of those decisions that, if you do them wrong, might kill your project.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, I don't know, the decision if interfaces get prefixed with an I or not might be important for you emotionally, but it probably doesn't kill your project. What kind of persistence store you use and how to interface that, that can kill a project. The latter is an architecture definition, architecture decision. And all these kinds of decisions make up your architecture. Mm-hmm. And that basically also implies that every system has an architecture. It just might be that it isn't a nice architecture and not documented and nobody really knows it. It just kind of happened. Because you're making decisions all the time, right? You, like in dgraph, I needed a way to create some graphical representation, and I decided to use GraphML and YAD for that. That's an architectural decision. If people really hate YAD and XML is not can't handle what I want from it, that would make dgraph pretty much unusable.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's
in clean code. Uncle Bob says or speaks about emergent architecture.
Yes.
Can we speak about emergent architecture if getting some decisions wrong could kill your project?
Absolutely. Uncle Bob also describes how this relates. If you do architecture, you have to make these decisions. And I know three ways how these decisions come along. Sometimes in the very, very early stages of a project, somebody makes these decisions, which is really, if you think about it, a stupid thing to do, because the very, very early stages of a project is exactly the stage when you have the fewest knowledge about the things that affect the decision or the correct decision. Mm-hmm. And the other way, which is probably equally stupid, is when the decision just happens by accident. Just somebody wants to store. Are you still there?
This is where I lost Jens twice. So we were talking about emerging architecture.
Exactly.
I kind of know where you're going. You told me about making decisions very early, like probably choosing to go on the host, like my current client. And
exactly this kind of
then
stuff.
you wanted to go on decisions that happen by accident.
Yeah, they are the decisions that happen by accident or just happen by whoever needs right now the decision or thinks he needs it, and you basically end up with random decisions, which can work out if you have competent developers that have kind of a good instinct of what to choose, and your requirements aren't that special, but that is basically relying on luck. And the way it, in my strict opinion, it really should be is you should push decision actively back as far as possible in order to learn as much as possible about the problem that you have to solve before you actually make a decision that hopefully solves your problems. And I really like the example Robert C. Martin gives for that. He writes about, I think it's fitness, basically a testing tool based on a wiki. And they early on thought like they need a database to store all the data of the wiki. Mm-hmm. And, but then when they thought now we need that, so let's create a database, they said, no, actually we don't. We just want to write some tests. So we can just create an interface, which looks like the interface that we eventually will have against the database. And use that to write our tests and provide basically a testing stub that stores just stuff in a hash map or something. And this went on, and they ended up never actually using a database. And just eventually wrote an implementation for this interface to store stuff in flat files, which was completely sufficient and much easier. And if you think about setting up such a tool, it's much easier to find a directory where you can put some files instead of actually installing a database and making sure it has the right version and has all the tables in it. And so I think that's really a good architectural decision not to have a database. But in the very beginning, it looked like they would need a database. This information you can only learn in the project. And actually, what I also like about this, by pushing back these kind of decisions, very often mean creating an interface and just creating the interface like you need it for the rest of your application without thinking too much about how it is implemented. I've seen it in many projects the other way around. From the very beginning, these decisions are made, and very popular choice in my surroundings are, let's use a relational database and use Hibernate or JPA to interface with that, which in some cases, because this was so clearly made in the very early phases of the project, so everybody knew we are going to use this technology, that this technology ended up all over the place. Actually, the UI creating Hibernate criteria objects, which then were used to create filter. It was kind of nice. It just was very direct, but caused a lot of problems when we wanted to do something which we couldn't directly map to Hibernate criteria. If we would have started with an interface, we would have a clean separation and still could have used Hibernate for a lot of stuff, but then could have the option that we didn't have in that instance, at least not in an easy way, to use something completely different for certain things that Hibernate can't deal with very good. And so you get basically an abstraction layer on very important places. Because we are talking about architecture decisions, so these are important decisions. So it's a great to have an interface there where you can, if you find out that you took the wrong decision, that you can actually change stuff about it.
Keep it flexible.
Yeah, and testable, and all the benefits of having an interface in the right position.
Is this where you would encourage newcomers to inquire and start learning, if they want to go slowly into architecture, or if they are coding but interested in architecture?
Well, newcomers and architecture don't really go together that well, I think. If I hear newcomer, I think about people that are new to software development, or at least new to software development in an enterprise world. And while I think everybody should understand the decisions, I see very few newcomers that actually can participate in these discussions. And contributing a lot. Of course, there are exceptions, and of course, they are also the newcomer in the sense of the newcomer architect, the aspiring architect who is currently maybe a solid developer and wants to become an architect. And yes, I think these kind of stuff. I think you can start learning a lot by reflecting about what is going on. Even if you are in a project as a normal developer, not involved in architectural decisions, you still can try to identify these decisions. In many projects, these aren't explicitly documented, where you can have a list of decisions and just read them up. In many cases, they are just there. Find them if you look really hard. And I think this kind of practice is could be really useful. Thinking, what are the architectural decisions made in my project, and how do they affect this project? What would be alternatives? What would it mean to replace our current relational database with, I don't know, some kind of NoSQL database? What kind of effects would that have? Just do everybody a favor and don't just try it in a midnight session to rip out the database and replace it by something completely different. In most cases, there are things you haven't thought about. Even if you're experienced but never used a NoSQL database, I'm sure that you will find some surprises, and not all of them will be pleasant.
It's like the circle of dependencies. You will find some.
Yes, exactly.
Well, great. We completely exploded Dymox, but
yeah, I noticed.
That's great discussion anyway. Is there anything you would like to end on? Something you want to plug? Are you speaking somewhere in the near future? You want to make some advertisement about that?
I think the next talk that is actually accepted is the Java Forum Nord in Hanover. So if anybody's listening to this and lives more in the northern part of Germany, definitely should check out that conference. It will happen for the second time. Actually, yes, there's one more thing. We really skimmed briefly about it. The thing about open source, which is at least one of the main topics we talked about, and you mentioned, or I mentioned, that I have like one or two dozen repositories. I think it's really a good idea to just get stuff out there. You basically never know when something sticks. I have a lot of my repositories are just stupid experiments that I started. I tried something and sometimes it ended before anything came out of it at all. Sometimes it ended with basically a proof of concept. I have repositories that consist of a single class, which are actually used. And if you, I think the mistake many people make, they think really hard and they think, well, this is not worth putting out there. And it doesn't cost anything to put it out there. It's like a couple of minutes to set up a repository, push your code, maybe write a nice README and pick a license. Apache is a nice idea for a license, I think. And that's it. And maybe somebody stumbles across it and finds it useful, and you get a nice mail and like, hey, thank you for this, or I used it. Or maybe you even get more ideas about what to do with this piece, and it starts growing. You never really know. I mean, JUnit started famously as a hacking session on a flight. In a couple of hours, a library was created that now literally every Java developer knows. And most of them, fortunately, uses it. So just get started. Whatever you find interesting, if you code something up, just don't let it die on your hard drive or solid state disk. Put it out on GitHub so other people can have fun with it too. And sometimes just don't read the comments.
Very wise words. Get started, get stuff out there, and don't read the comments. Well, thank you very much, Jens. That was very, very interesting. I hope we can do that again someday. Maybe this time on mentoring. I really want to get this discussion again out someday.
Yeah, we can repeat that maybe with Stephen.
Yeah, if he's okay with English this time.
I'm sure he is.
So we'll have to schedule that.
Okay, we'll do that.
Right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And there goes another DevTree interview. Help the project by rating the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and sending me your comments and suggestions of guests to invite. I eat them for breakfast. I mean, comments, not the guests. Well, anyhow, until next time, Tim logging off. Bye-bye.